There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At WashableSofas.com, you'll find the Anabay Sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slip covers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slip covers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabay has you covered. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Anatole Levin, my colleague of many decades observing Afghanistan. He's been there. He's observed it. He's written about it. And he has the advantage of the fact that he's an Englishman. And England and Afghanistan, Britain and Afghanistan have a long and troubled history. Back and forth. This is the fourth Anglo-Afghan War. The first dates to the early part of the 19th century, 1839. That war ended in a catastrophe. So did the war under Disraeli, 1879-80. Catastrophe. The war in 1919. Catastrophe. Now I believe that the word catastrophe is routinely used by significant figures in the European Union. Catastrophe. So, lessons learned? No. However, there are lessons to draw upon, and Anatole is writing of these matters. I interrupted him when he was speaking of Iran. But the reason Iran is part of the story is that this is the romantic version of the great game. The great game was, in the 19th century, understood between Whitehall, London, and Petersburg, the capital of the Tsarist Empire. That became the Soviet Empire when they moved the capital to Moscow. But the great game continued. And the Central Asian states, the borderland of the South Caucasus, all of that is part of this larger story of a thousands of years old civilization. I learned this when I traveled to Baku and to Tashkent over these last years. Afghanistan was part of that civilization long before there was development, so-called, we call civilization in Northern Europe. There was an active scientific and geographic and trade-based culture in what we now see as Afghanistan, what we now see as Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, all the stands were part of this fluid culture of city-states. Beg pardon, Anatole, but I've been rocked by the remarks about Afghanistan being savage these last years. And from the point of view of a country that's just 240 years old, you understand there's irony here. However, I interrupted you about Iran. This is the great game. Do I say that correctly, Anatole?
Yes, absolutely. But I think you're also right. Britain's engagement in the great game has, lasted for about 120 years, the British Indian Empire. We've come back, of course, with the Americans later. America's involvement, we'll have to see. It started really with the US, efforts against the Soviet Union that have been going on now for 50 years or so, but possibly an episode. Iran has been there, often ruling over large areas of Afghanistan, or on the other hand, sometimes being ruled by dynasties based in Afghanistan for something like 2,700 years. I think that's very important to note. We, the West, were always going to go home one day. The people in the neighborhood, they will stay. And I think in future, any positive Western influence in Afghanistan will have to be exerted, in some form of concord with Afghanistan's neighbors. That's the only way we can shape that country in any sort of positive way.
You observe that there's geography here that's important. The highlands and the lowlands. The Pashtun people of the highlands, what I recall is Winston Churchill's account of, as a subaltern, shooting it out with the Afridis. That was very exciting to him, the expedition into Afghanistan was part of guarding the Indian frontier. But please explain how the Pashtuns see their responsibilities and their dignity in the highlands, a regard towards the lowlands.
Well, like tribal people elsewhere in the world, the Pashtuns of the mountains basically hate state authority and state control. And of course they have some reason because, you know, states in Afghanistan, like states in medieval Europe and elsewhere, were basically very nasty towards ordinary people, very exploitative, very cruel. And so, I mean, this I think we also didn't understand in Afghanistan, you know, we sort of instinctively thought, oh, people must want a strong state. No, they don't. I mean, they would feel differently, of course, if Afghan states had ever provided them with hospitals, schools, electricity, roads, any of this, but they never did. All Afghan states ever gave them was, you know, brutal and corrupt policemen, corrupt judges, tax collectors. And so there is a sort of instinctive rejection of state authority in that part of the world, unless it comes in a limited form and in a religious guise, which is pretty much the mixture the Taliban have offered.
The region is, however, mixed of tribal mixes, and there are the people of the north of Afghanistan and the people of the south. I've learned this from you, Anatole, so I'm just repeating your lessons. Please correct me if I'm wrong. The Pashtuns are dominant for the story that we're now telling, the Kabul. But there are the Tajiks, there are the Uzbeks, there are, well, the Shia of Iran, all of this mixture. That suggests that at best we could hope for a federal, what we call a federal state. However, the Afghans do it differently. They all meet together and they have their chieftains or their leadership agree on a consensus. Is that possible with the Taliban? Because the Taliban is presented again and again with anecdote as medieval.
Well, as far as the other ethnicities are concerned, something very interesting has happened recently, which is that the Taliban have stopped being a purely Pashtun force and have actually had a lot of successful recruitment among the other nationalities, except the Shia, for obvious religious reasons. But there are now a lot of Tajiks, a lot of Uzbeks and Aynak and others in the ranks of the Taliban. So it could be that the Taliban will preside over a much more harmonious society from the ethnic point of view than they did in the 90s. We'll have to see, of course. That's not guaranteed. But certainly, I mean, the Taliban are, yes, I mean, in a sense, a medieval force, with their, you know, their deep religious conviction, their limited form of government, their very strong, you know, warrior cast of mind. But then I'm absolutely sure that old Winston Churchill would have said that this is the form of government that actually suits Afghanistan. The British, admittedly, after a couple of catastrophes, gave up the idea that they were going to rule Afghanistan and shape it, you know, as they wished, and basically adopted a strategy of trying to manage and influence Afghanistan from a distance while leaving Afghanistan to govern itself. I think that is how we will have to approach Afghanistan in future. Certainly our attempt to transform Afghanistan in our own image has proved a total failure.
You cite a Pashtun proverb in one of your essays about how we got to here. Feuding ate up the mountains and taxes ate up the plains. Can we expect that that has not changed and that the Taliban government, however it presents itself to the television cameras, will still be living with this proverb?
I'm sure they will. Every Afghan government has had to live with this. Of course, I mean, this is the biggest question for Afghanistan in future. Where are they going to get the money from? They hope to get the money from China. The Chinese, I think, are, you know, the Chinese are very hard-headed about this. Certainly, if they are going to invest money in Afghanistan and give aid to Afghanistan, they will expect that the Taliban will hold to their international promises. And at that point, I'll say again, I think that Chinese presence and Chinese influence in Afghanistan will be good for everybody, including us. You know, this idea of turning Afghanistan again into a battlefield for influence in between China and the West, that I think is profoundly stupid. International terrorism threatens us all. Heroin threatens us all. Here, there are a couple of areas, at least, where, you know, we can go on cooperating with our rivals, and I think we should try to do so.
There is an echo of the old days here with the headline from the London Times. The Afghan resistance to the Taliban begins in the Panjshir Valley. The first vice president has joined the son of the Mujahideen hero killed by the Al-Qaeda, Massoud, in vowing to fight on with whoever will join them. The question I have is this also Afghanistan's history, that the Panjshir Valley becomes the centerpiece of the rebels and that we live together with a rebellion constant? Is that something the British also experienced in the 19th century?
Well, we didn't particularly experience it from the Panjshir Valley, and certainly ever since the Soviet start of the Soviet occupation, or actually the start of rebellion against the communists, the Panjshir was the absolute heart of resistance, first to them and then later of Tajik resistance.
So what we're looking at here is reproducing. What we're looking at here then is reproducing the something that's familiar with Kabul. The one capital we didn't deal with profoundly that is rocked by this is the question of how the U.S. will respond to this. I've left that out of the formula here because the U.S. is all chock-a-block. You know this. You report very carefully on us. We're all in many directions. But is it now the position in Afghanistan that the U.S. has left and is not coming back, is no longer a power for us to deal with? And does that change the formula for the future of the Taliban government?
Well, I'm sure the Taliban think that. The question is whether the U.S. will support anti-Taliban rebellions, as in the Panjshir. We'll have to see. Or whether, on the other hand, you know, after a certain interval, America will decide that in order to get things it wants, especially concerning international terrorism, that it will need to deal with the Taliban. That will be very difficult for America to do, of course. But look, let's face it, the Taliban have won. You know, they've beaten us. If we want to both, you know, get what we want internationally from the Taliban and try to shape them in a positive or a more positive direction at home over treatment of women, for example, we are going to have to deal with them. And quite frankly, we're also going to have to bribe them with international aid, which we probably, you know, look, if we have any commitment to if any of this talk of commitment to the Afghan people meant anything, then, you know, we should go on trying to feed them. We should go on supporting hospitals. We should go on, you know, supporting women doctors and women, you know, and clinics and things, supporting women, you know, delivering women's babies. If we stop that in order to punish the Taliban, I think that will also be betraying ordinary Afghans, because by continuing aid, of course, by also threatening in certain circumstances to reduce or cut off that aid, we have some possibility, as I say, of influencing the Taliban in a positive direction. If we break off relations, break off aid, and shout at them, you know, and we will get nowhere. And we won't just get nowhere for ourselves, we will get nowhere for the Afghan people.
Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, commenting on what we know so far of the tragedy in Kabul. When we come back, I will recall my youth in Vietnam. Is that a model? We've used it for the tragedy. Is that a model for the future in a positive sense? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Visit washablesofas.com and discover Anabay, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices, with sofas starting at $699. Anabay brings you the ultimate in furniture innovation with a modular design that allows you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabay is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slides right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get up to 60% off plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.